caught between two angry pagan armies, he was quickly killed, very dead. So, Binnebik waved his stick, beating down a high tussock of grass. A story whose philosophy is difficult. At least for we Canuck, who prefer both being what you call pagan and being what I call alive. The lector in Navan, however, called Hodirund a martyr, and in the early days of Erkinland named this place a church and abbey for the order Hodirundian.
Was it a terrible battle? Simon asked.
The Rimmersgard men called this place Boneyard. The later battle at Ach Samrath was perhaps bloodier, but there was treachery there. Here, at the Knock, it was breast to breast, sword on sword, and blood running like the streams of first thaw.
The sun, sliding low in the sky, beat full in their faces. The afternoon breeze, which had sprung up in earnest, bent the long grasses and tossed the hovering insects so that they danced in the air, tiny flashes of golden light. Kantaka came charging back through the field, obliterating in her approach the sawing, hissing music of stem on stem. As they began to trudge up a long incline, she circled them, waggling her wide head in the air and yipping excitedly. Simon shielded his eyes, but could see nothing beyond the rise but the treetops of the forest's edge. He turned to ask Binnebik if they were almost there, but the troll was staring down as he walked, brows knit in concentration, paying no heed to Simon or the capering wolf. After some time had passed in silence, sullied only by the swish of their passage through the heavy grass and an occasional agitated bark from Kantaka, Simon's empty stomach steeled him to ask again. He had no sooner opened his mouth when Binnebik astonished him by breaking into high, keening song.
Ai ereb irigu, kai shikisi aroya, shise, shise borosa ea, pekoru, ndetu.
As Simon climbed that light-soaked, wind-rippled hill, the words and the strange tune seemed a lament of birds, a desolate call from the high, lonely, unforgiving spaces of the air.
A Scythi song.
Binnebik gave Simon an odd, shy look.
I am not singing it well. It is about this place, where the first Scythi died at the hands of man, where blood was first spilled by the warring of men on the lands of the Scythi.
As he finished speaking, he flapped a hand at Kantaka, who was bumping his leg with her broad muzzle.
Inik Aya, he told her. She is smelling people now. And food cooking, he muttered apologetically.
What did the song say? Simon asked. The words, I mean.
The strangeness still chilled him, but at the same moment it reminded him how big the world truly was, and how little he had seen, even in the busy hayholt. Small, 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 he felt, smaller than the little troll climbing beside him.
I doubt, Simon, whether the Scythi words can truly be made for singing in mortal languages, whether their thought is being properly passed on. Do you see? Even worse, it is not the language of my birthplace that we are speaking, you and I. But I can try.
They strode on some moments longer. Kantaka had grown bored at last, or had thought better of sharing her lupine enthusiasms with these cloddish humans, and had disappeared over the top of the rise.
This, I am thinking, is near in meaning,
Binnebik said at last, and then chanted rather than sang.
At the gate of the west, between the sun's eye and the hearts of the ancestors, falls a tear. Track of light, track of earthward falling light, touches iron and becomes smoke.
Binnebik laughed self-consciously.
Do you see, in the woodcrafty hands of a troll, The song of air is becoming words of lampish stone.
No, Simon said, I don't understand it exactly, but it makes me feel something.
That is then good, Benedict smiled. But no words of mine can be matching the Sith's own songs, especially this one. It is one of the longest, I am told, and saddest. It is also said that the Earl King, Leonegato, made it himself. In the last hours before he was killed by... Ah, look, we are now at the top.
Simon raised his eyes. In truth, they had almost reached the summit of the long rise, the endless sea of Aldeota's huddling treetops stretching before them. But I don't think he stopped talking because of that, Simon thought. I think he was about to say something he didn't want to say. How did you learn to sing Sithi songs, Benabik? He asked, as they clambered the last few steps to stand on the hill's wide bask.
We will speak of it, Simon, the troll replied, staring around. But now, look, there is the way down to St. Hoderon's.
Starting barely more than a long stone's throw beneath them, clinging to the hill's sloping side like moss growing on an ancient tree, twined rows and rows of evenly spaced, carefully tended vines. They were separated one from the other by horizontal terraces cut into the hillside, edges rounded as though the soil had been shaped long ago. Paths ran between the vines, winding down the slope as sinuously as the plants themselves. In the valley below, sheltered on one side by this first small cousin of the Wheeled Helm Hills, and on the other by the dark border of the forest, a whole basket-weave pattern of farming plots could be seen, laid out with the meticulous symmetry of an illuminated manuscript. Farther along, just visible around the jut of the hill, were the small outbuildings of the abbey, a rough but well-tended collection of wooden sheds, and a fenced-in field, empty now of sheep or cows. A gate, the one small moving object in the massive tapestry, swung slowly back and forth.
Follow the path, Simon, and it is soon we shall be eating, and perhaps also imbibing a small of the monasterial vintage.
Benedict started down at a quick walk. Within moments, he and Simon were threading their way among the grapevines, while Kantaka, scornful of the slow traverse of her companions, sprang down the hillside, leaping over the curling vines without touching a stake or crushing a single grape beneath her great paws. Watching his feet as he hurried down the steep path, feeling his heels skid a little on every long stride, Simon suddenly felt, rather than saw, a presence before him. Thinking that the troll had halted to wait for him, he looked up with a sour expression, about to say something about showing some mercy for folk who did not grow up on a mountain. Instead, when his eyes met the nightmare shape before him, he shouted in fear and lost his footing, tumbling back onto his rump and sliding two arms' lengths down the path. Benabik heard him and turned, racing back up the hill to find Simon sitting in the dirt beneath a large, tattered scarecrow. The little man looked at the scarecrow, hanging off-center on a wide stake, its crude painted face all but wiped away by wind and rain, then looked down to Simon, sucking his scuffed palms in the path. Benabik suppressed his laughter until he had helped the boy up, grabbing with his small strong hands at Simon's elbow and levering him to his feet, but then could hold back no longer. He turned and started back down, leaving Simon frowning angrily as the smothered sounds of the little man's mirth floated up to him. Simon bitterly knocked the worst of the dirt off his breeches and checked the two packages tucked in his belt, arrow and manuscript, to make sure neither was damaged. It was obvious Benabik couldn't know about the thief hanged at the crossroads, but he had been there to see the Sithi strung up in the woodsman's trap. So why should it be so laughable for Simon to be startled? He felt very foolish, but as he looked again at the scarecrow, he still felt a tremor of foreboding. He reached up to it, grasped the hollow sack of a head, rough and cool to the touch, and folded it over, tucking the top into the shapeless, tattered cloak that flapped at its shoulders, so that the blurry, sightless eyes would be hidden. Let the troll laugh. Binnebik, composed now, was waiting farther down. He did not apologize, but patted Simon on the wrist and smiled. Simon returned the smile, but his was smaller than Binnebik's.
"When I was here 3 moons ago," Binnebik said, "on my trip passing southward, I ate the most wonderful venison. The brothers are permitted to take a very few deer from the king's forest for the succoring of wayfarers. And themselves, it needs no saying. Oh-ho! There it is! And smoke is rising."
They had rounded the last curve of the hill. The mournful sound of the squeaking gate was directly below them. Just ahead and down the slope were the clustered thatch roofs of the abbey. Smoke was indeed rising, a thin plume floating up to whirl and dissipate in the wind off the hilltop. But it was not coming from chimney or smoke hole.
"Binnebik," Simon said, surprise not quite turned to alarm.
"Daughter of the mountains."
The gate banged shut and immediately popped open again.
"It is a terrible guest who has come to St. Hotteran's house."
To Simon, who had never seen the abbey before, the smoking waste below seemed Binnebik's very story of the boneyard come to life. As in the terrible mad hours beneath the castle, he felt the jealous claws of the past pushing through to drag present time down into a dark place of regret and fear. The chapel, the main abbey, and most of the outbuildings had been reduced to steaming husks. The charred roof beams, their burdens of wattle and thatch burned away, lay exposed to the ironic spring sky, like the blackened ribs of a hungry god's feast. Scattered about the surroundings, as if dice thrown by the selfsame god, were the bodies of at least a score of men, as rag-jointed and lifeless as the scarecrow on the hilltop.
"Choco stones," Binnebik breathed, still staring,
and tapped himself lightly on the chest with the heel of his hand. He moved forward, pulling his bag from his shoulder, and hurried down the hill. Kantaka, vindicated, barked and capered joyfully.
"Wait,"
Simon said, barely a whisper.
"Wait," he called and lurched after. "Come back! What are you doing? You'll be killed!" "Hours old, this is,"
Binnebik called without turning. Simon saw him halt briefly to lean over the first body he reached. A moment later, he trotted on, gasping, heart racing with fear despite the obvious truth of the little man's words. Simon looked at the same body as he passed. It was a man in a black robe, a monk by his appearance. His face was hidden, pressed into the grass. An arrowhead had pushed violently out through the back of his neck. Flies walked daintily on the dried blood. A few steps later, Simon tripped and fell, catching himself painfully with the palms of his hands on the gravel path. When he saw what he had tripped over and saw the flies resettling on the upturned eyes, he was violently, excruciatingly sick. When Binnebik found him, Simon had crawled into the shade of a chestnut tree. The youth's head nodded bonelessly as Binnebik, like a tender but efficient mother, wiped the bile from his chin with a hank of grass. The carrion stench was everywhere.
"Bad it is, bad."
Binnebik touched Simon's shoulder gently, as if to reassure himself that the youth was real. Then squatted on his haunches, narrowing his eyes against the last red rays of sunshine.
"I can find no one that is living here. Monks for the greatest part, all dressed in abbey robes. But there are others too."
"Others?" It was a gurgle.
"Men in traveler's clothes, frost march men, stopping here for a night perhaps, although there is a goodish quantity of them. Several are wearing beards, and to me have the looking of Rimmer's men. It is a puzzlement."
"Where's Kantaka?" Simon asked weakly.
He found himself strangely worried for the wolf, although she of all of them was probably least in danger.
"Running, smelling. She is very excited.
Binnivik, Simon noticed, had his stick pulled apart and had tucked the knife section into his belt.
"I wonder," the troll said, staring at the rising smoke as Simon finally sat up. "What was bringing this on? Bandits? A kind of battling for religious matters? I hear that it is not uncommon with you Aedonites. Or what? Most curious."
"Binnivik," Simon hawked and spat. His mouth tasted like a pig keeper's boots. "I'm frightened." Somewhere in the distance, Kantaka barked, a surprisingly high-pitched sound.
"Frightened?" Binnivik's smile was thin as twine. "Frightened is what you should be."
Though his face appeared clear and unworried, a kind of stunned defenselessness lurked behind the troll's eyes. That scared Simon more than had anything else. There was something more, a hint of resignation, as if the awful thing had not been entirely unexpected.
"I am thinking,"
Binnivik began, when Kantaka's yipping suddenly rose into a snarling crescendo. The troll sprang to his feet.
"She has found something," he said,
and pulled the startled youth to his feet with a strong tug on the wrist.
"Or something finds her."
With Simon staggering behind him, impulses of flight and fear twittering through his skull like bats, Binnivik dug away in the direction of the sounds. As he ran, he reached his finger into his blowpipe to push something into place. Simon knew, a heavy, forbidding realization, that this dart was black-tipped. They ran across the abbey grounds, away from the wreckage and through the orchard, following the sounds of Kantaka's distress. A blizzard of apple blossoms fell all around. The wind prodded and pushed along the edge of the forest. Less than 10 running steps into the wood, they saw Kantaka, hackles upraised, her growl so deep that Simon could feel it in his stomach. She had caught a monk and had backed him against a poplar trunk. The man held his pectoral tree on high, as if to call heavenly lightning down on the offending beast. Despite his heroic stance, the sick pallor of his face and his trembling arm showed that he expected no lightning to come. His pop eyes, exaggerated by fear, were fixed on Kantaka. He had not yet seen the two newcomers.
"Hedonis fielis, extolan in me,"
his wide lips worked convulsively. The shadows of leaves mottled his pink skull.
"Kantaka!"
Binnivik shouted.
"Sosa!"
Kantaka growled, but her ears twitched.
"Sosa aya!"
The troll whacked his hollow stick against his thigh. The crack echoed. With a last hacking snarl, Kantaka dropped her head and trotted back toward Binnivik. The monk, staring at Simon and the troll as though they were quite as terrifying as the wolf, swayed slightly and then toppled backward to land sitting on the ground with the stunned expression of a child who has hurt himself but has not yet realized that he wants to cry.
"Osiris, the merciful," he gabbled at last as the pair hurried towards him. "Osiris, the merciful, the merciful."
A wild look came into his bulging eyes.
"Leave me alone, you pagan monsters," he shouted
and tried to struggle to his feet.
"Murdering bastards! Pagan bastards!"
His heels skidded from beneath him and he sat down again, mumbling.
"A troll! A murdering troll!"
He began to pinken, his color coming back. He sucked in a great convulsive breath, then looked as if at last he truly would cry. Binnivik stopped. Grabbing Kantaka by the neck, he gestured Simon forward, saying,
"Help him!"
Simon walked slowly, trying with some difficulty to compose his face into something befitting a friend coming to help. His own heart, after all, was drumming at his ribcage like a woodpecker. "It's all well now," he said. "All well." The monk had covered his face with his sleeve.
"Killed them all. Now you want us too?" he cried,
his voice, though muffled, sounding more of self-pity than fear.
"A rumorous man he is," said Binnivik. "As if you would not be guessing already to hear him at slandering the Canuck."
The troll made a disgusted noise.
"Help him up, friend Simon, and let us take him out into the light."
Simon got the man's bony, black-robed elbow and laboriously steered him onto his feet. But when he tried to guide him toward Binnivik, the man pulled away.
"What are you doing?"
he shouted, feeling on his chest for his tree.
"Making me desert the others? No, you just get away from me."
Others? Simon turned questioningly to Pinnabic. The troll shrugged and scratched the wolf's ears. Kentucky seemed to grin as if the spectacle amused her. Are there others alive? The boy asked gently. We will help you, and them too, if we can. I am Simon, and that is my friend Pinnabic.
The monk stared at him suspiciously.
I believe you met Kentucky already, Simon added, and immediately felt sorry for the poor joke. Come, who are you? Where are these others?
The monk, whose composure was beginning to return, gave him a long, mistrustful look, then turned to stare briefly at the troll and wolf. When he turned back to Simon, some of the tension had left his face.
If you are indeed a good Edonite acting in charity, then I ask your forgiveness.
The monk's tone was stiff, as in one unused to apologizing.
I am Brother Hengfisk. Does that wolf, he turned his gaze sideways, does he accompany you?
She does, Pinnabic said sternly before Simon could answer. Too bad it is that she frightened you, Remus man, but you must notice that she did you no harm.
Hengfisk did not reply to Pinnabic.
I have left my two charges for too long a time, he told Simon. I must go to them now.
We'll come with you, Simon replied. Perhaps Pinnabic can help. He is very gifted with herbs and things.
The Rimmer's man briefly raised his eyebrows, which made his eyes seem to bulge all the more. His smile was bitter.
It is a kind thought, boy, but I'm afraid Brother Langrian and Brother Darkeyes are not going to be helped by any woodland poultices.
He turned on his heel and struck off, rather unsteadily, into the deeper forest.
But wait, called Simon. What happened to the abbey?
I do not know, Hengfisk said without turning. I was not here.
Simon looked to Pinnabic for help, but the troll made no immediate move to follow. Instead, he called after the limping monk.
Oh, brother, Hengfisk!
The monk whirled furious.
My name is Hengfisk, troll.
Simon noted how quickly color came to his face.
I was merely making translation for my friend,
Pinnabic grinned his yellow grin,
who is not speaking the language of Remusgard. You say you are not knowing what happened. Where were you when your brethren were being so very slaughtered?
The monk seemed about to spit back a reply, but instead reached his hand up to his tree and clutched it. A moment later, in a quieter voice, he said,
Come, then, and see. I have no secrets from you, troll, or from my god.
He stalked away.
Why were you making him mad, Pinnabic? Simon whispered. Haven't enough bad things happened here already?
Binnabik's eyes were slits, but he had not lost his grin.
Perhaps I am being unkind, Simon, but you heard his speaking. You have been seeing his eyes. Do not let yourself be fooled by the wearing of a holy robe. We cannot have wakened too many times in the night, finding eyes like this Hengfisk's looking down on us, and torches and axes close by. Your Osiris Aedon has not burned with success that hatred from his northern heart.
With a cluck for Kentucky to follow, the troll moved after the stiff-backed priest.
But listen to you, Simon said, holding Binnabik's eye. You're full of hatred, too.
Ah,
the troll lifted a finger before his now expressionless face.
But I am not claiming to believe in your, forgive the saying, upside-down God of Mercy.
Simon took a breath to say something, then thought better of it. Brother Hengfisk turned once, silently taking notice of their presence. He did not speak again for some time. The light that filtered through the leaves was fast diminishing. Within a short time, his angular, black-robed form was little more than a moving shadow before them. Simon was startled when he turned and said,
Here.
He led them around the base of a great fallen tree, whose exposed roots resembled more than anything else a huge broom. a broom that would have fired the imagination of Rachel the Dragon toward heroic, legendary feats of sweeping. Simon's wry thought of Rachel, coupled with the day's events, brought on a pang of homesickness so intense that he stumbled, catching himself with a hand against the scaly bark of the fallen tree. Hengfisk was kneeling, throwing branches into a small fire that glowed in a shallow pit. Lying beside the fire, one on either side in the shelter of the tree's toppled length, were two men.
"This is Langrian," Brother Hengfisk said, indicating the one on the right,
whose face was largely obscured by a bloody bandage made of sacking.
"I found him, the only one alive at the abbey, when I returned. I think Aidan will take him back soon."
Even in the fading light, Simon could see that Brother Langrian's skin, that which showed, was pale and waxy. Hengfisk threw another stick on the fire, as Binnabik, without meeting the Rimmer's man's eyes once, kneeled down beside the injured man and began to gently examine him.
"That one is Dark Eyes," Hengfisk said, gesturing to the other man, who lay as limply as Langrian, but without visible injury. "It was him I went out to find when he did not come back from his vigil. When I brought Dark Eyes back, carried him."
There was bitter pride in Hengfisk's tone.
"I returned to find all dead."
He made the sign of the tree on his breast.
"All but Langrian."
Simon moved close to Brother Dark Eyes, a thin young man with a long nose and the blue chin stubble of the Hernesteri.
"What happened to him? What's wrong?"
"I do not know, boy," Hengfisk said. "He is mad. He has caught up some fever of the brain."
He returned to his search for firewood. Simon watched Dark Eyes for a moment, noting the man's labored breathing and the slight trembling of his thin eyelids. As he turned to look over to Binnabik, who was delicately unwinding the bandage around Langrian's head, a white hand came up like a snake from the black robe before him and caught his shirt front in a horrifically powerful grip. Dark Eyes, eyes still shut, had stiffened, his back so bowed that his waist rose from the ground. His head was thrown back and snapped from side to side.
"Binnabik!" Simon shouted in terror. He's...
"Ah!" The voice that pushed up from Dark Eye's straining throat was harsh with pain.
"The Black Wagon? See, it is coming for me!"
He thrashed again like a landed fish, and his words brought Simon a thrill of reawakening horror.
"The hilltop. I remember something. And the creak of black wheels. Oh, Morghenis, what am I doing here?"
A moment later, while Binnabik and Hengfisk stared in amazement from the far side of the fire pit, Dark Eyes had pulled Simon forward until the youth's face was almost touching the Hernesteerman's own fear-stretched features.
"They are taking me back,"
the monk hissed.
Back to that terrible place."
Shockingly, his eyes popped open and stared blindly into Simon's own. A hand's breadth away. Simon could not struggle out of the monk's grip, even though Binnabik was now at his side, trying to help pull him free.
"You! No!" Dark Eyes cried. "You know who it is. You have been marked. Marked like I was. I saw them as they passed. The white foxes. They walked in my dream. The white foxes. The master has sent them to put ice on our hearts and take away our souls on their black, black wagon."
And then Simon was loose, gasping and sobbing. Binnabik and Hengfisk held the twitching monk until he finally stopped thrashing. The silence of the black forest returned, surrounding the tiny campfire as the gulfs of night embrace a dying star. Chapter 20. The Shadow of the Wheel. He was standing on the open plain at the center of a vast, shallow bowl of grass, a speck of pale, upright life in the midst of an endless riot of green. Simon had never felt quite so exposed, so naked to the sky. The field sloped up and away from him. The horizon on all sides made a tight seal of grass and stone-grey sky. After a span that could have been moments or years in such impersonal, fixed timelessness, the horizon was breached. With the ponderous creak of a ship of war under heavy wind, a dark object appeared above the rim that was the outermost limit of Simon's view. It rose and rose, impossibly tall, until its shadow fell across Simon at the valley's depth. The shadow's impact was so sudden that it seemed almost to resound as it struck a deep, reverberating hum that shook Simon's bones. The great bulk of the thing came clear against the sky as it stood for a long moment poised on the valley's edge. It was a wheel, a huge black wheel as tall as a tower. Sunk into the twilight of its shadow, Simon could only gape as it began to turn with excruciating deliberateness, to slowly roll down the long green slope, spouting flayed gouges of sod behind it. Simon stood frozen in its awful path as it ground on, as inexorable as the millstones of hell. Now it was over him, rim foremost, a black trunk stretching to the firmament, raining turf down all round. The ground beneath Simon's feet pitched forward as the weight of the wheel tipped the bed of the earth. He stumbled, and as he found his balance, the black rim was upon him. As he stared, mute and horrified, a grey shadow passed before his eyes, a grey shadow with a flashing core, a sparrow flying madly past with some bright thing caught up in its curling grip. He flicked his eyes to follow. And then, as if it had somehow caught at his heart in its swift passage, he flung himself after it, out of reach of the plunging wheel. But even as he dove, and the wall-wide rim smashed down, Simon's pants leg was snagged by a burning cold nail protruding from the great wheel's outer edge. The sparrow, only inches away, fluttered free, spiraling up grey on grey against the slate sky like a moth, its glinting burden disappearing with it into the twilight. A great voice spoke, "You have been marked." The wheel took Simon and tumbled him, shook him like a hound breaking a rat's neck. Then it rolled on, yanking him high up into the air. Dangling, he was pulled skyward, the ground rocking and pitching beneath his head like a pulsing green sea. The wind of the wheel's passage was all around him as he rose, circling toward the apex. The blood sang in his ears. Scrabbling with his hands in the grass and mud that clotted the broad rim, Simon pulled himself painfully upright, riding the wheel as though it were the back of some cloud-tall beast. He rose ever nearer to the arching sky. He reached the top, and for a moment sat perched at the world's summit. All the spreading fields of Austin Ard were visible beyond the rim of the valley. The sunlight lanced through the dim sky to touch on the battlements of a castle and onto a beautiful shining spire, the only thing in the world that seemed as tall as the black wheel. He blinked, seeing something familiar in its sweeping line, but even as it began to come clear, the wheel ground on, pushing him over the top, then pulling him swiftly toward the ground so far below. He struggled with the nail, ripping at his pants leg to work himself loose, but somehow he and the nail became one. He could not break free. The ground leaped up. The two, Simon and the virgin green earth, were rushing together with a noise like the horns of the final day, booming through the valley. He struck. The two came together, and the wind and the light and the music blew away like a candle flame. Suddenly, Simon was in darkness, deep in earth which parted before him like water. There were voices around him, slow, halting voices that issued from mouths full of choking dirt. "Who enters our house? Who comes to disturb our sleep, our long sleep? They will steal from us. The thieves will take from us our quiet and our dark beds. They will drag us up again through the bright gate." As the mournful voices cried, Simon felt hands clutch at him, hands as cold and dry as bone, or as wet and soft as burrowing roots, stretching, twining fingers, reaching out to catch him up to empty breasts. But they could not stop him. The wheel rolled, rolled, grinding him downward ever farther until the voices died behind him and he was sliding through gelid, silent darkness. Darkness. "Where are you, boy? Are you dreaming? I can almost touch you." It was Priorati's voice that suddenly spoke, and he felt the malevolent weight of the alchemist's thoughts behind it.
I know now who you are. Morgani's boy, a scullion, a meddler. You have seen things you should not have seen, kitchen boy. Trifled with things beyond you. You know far too much. I will search you out. Where are you?
And then there was a greater darkness, a shadow beneath the shadow of the wheel, and deep in that shadow two red fires bloomed, eyes that must have gazed from a skull horribly full of flame.
No, mortal, a voice said, and in his head it had the sound of ashes and earth and the mute, unvoiced end of things. No, this is not for you.
The eyes flared, full of curiosity and glee.
We will take this one, priest.
Simon felt Priorati's hold slipping away, the alchemist's power withering before the dark thing.
Welcome, it said. This is the Storm King's house, here beyond the darkest gate. What is your name?
And the eyes fell in like crumbling embers, and the emptiness behind them burned colder than ice, hotter than any fire, and darker than any shadow.
No,
Simon thought he shouted, but his mouth too was full of earth.
I won't tell you.
Perhaps we will give you a name. You must have a name, little fly, little dust speck, so that we will know you when we meet. You must be marked.
No!
He tried to struggle free, but the weight of 1,000 years of earth and stone were upon him.
I don't want a name! I don't want a name! I don't want a name from you!
Even as his last cry echoed out through the trees, Binnabik was crouching over him, a look of real concern etched on his face. The weak morning sunlight, sourceless and directionless, filled the glade.
A madman, and one near death I have already to nurse, Binnabik said as Simon sat up. And now you must start shouting in your sleep as well?
He wanted it to be a joke, but the morning was too cold and thin to support the attempt. Simon was shivering.
Oh, Binnabik,
He felt a trembling, sickly smile come to his face. Forced out by the simple fact of being in the light, of being on top of the ground.
I had a terrible, terrible dream.
I am not very surprised, the troll said,
and squeezed Simon's shoulder.
A terrible day yesterday would not by chance alone lead to less than restful sleeping.
The little man straightened up.
If you like, be free to find something to eat in my bag. I am attending the two monks.
He pointed to the dark shapes on the far side of the campfire. The nearer one, who Simon guessed was Langrian, was wrapped in a dark green cloak.
Where is...
Simon remembered the name after a few moments.
Hengfisk.
His head was pounding, and his jaw throbbed as though he had been cracking nuts with his teeth.
The unpleasant Rimmus man, who, in fairness it is necessary to say, did give his cloak for warming Langrian, is off searching in the wreckage of his home for food and such things. I must be returning to my wards, Simon, if you are feeling better.
Oh, certainly. How are they?
Langrian, I have pleasure to say, is much improved.
Binnabik gave a little nod of satisfaction.
He has been sleeping quietly for some long time. A claim you cannot also be making. Hmm?
The troll smiled.
Brother Dorkais, sadly, is beyond my help. But he is not sick except in his fearful thoughts. Him I have given something to help sleep also. Now please, forgive. I must look at Brother Langrian's dressings.
Binnabik stood and stumped off around the fire pit, stepping over Kantaka, who lay sleeping near the warm stones, and whose back Simon had previously taken for another large rock. The wind lightly fingered the leaves of the oak tree above his head, as Simon riffled through Binnebik's bag. He pulled out one small sack that felt as though it might contain breakfast. But even before he opened it, a clinking noise told him it held the strange bones he had seen before. A further search turned up smoked, dried meat, wrapped in a rough cloth. But as soon as he had the package open, he realized that the last thing he wanted to do was put food of any kind into his churning stomach.
"Is there any water, Binnebik? Where's your skin?"
"Better, Simon,"
the troll called from his crouch over Brother Langrian.
"A stream there is, just a short walk down this way."
He pointed, then reached down and tossed Simon the skin bag.
"Feeling this will be a help for me."
As Simon picked up the skin, he saw his twin bundles lying nearby. On an impulse, he caught up the rag-wrapped manuscript and brought it with him as he walked down to the stream. The streamlet moved sluggishly, and its eddies were clogged with twigs and leaves. Simon had to clear a space before he could lean down and bring up handfuls of water to splash his face. He scrubbed hard with his fingers. It felt as though the smoke and blood of the ruined abbey's ending had worked its way into his every pore and wrinkle. Afterward, he drank several great swallows, then filled Binnebik's bag. He sat down on the bank, and his mind turned to the dream that had cloaked his thoughts, like a dank mist since he had arisen. Like Brother Dokai's wild words of the night before, the dream had raised dreadful shadows in Simon's heart. But the daylight was even now melting them away like unquiet ghosts, leaving only a residue of fear. All he remembered was the great black wheel as it had borne down upon him. All else was gone, leaving black, empty spots in his mind, doors of forgetfulness he could not open. Still, he knew that he was caught up in something larger than just the struggle of royal brothers, greater even than the death of that good old man Morghenes, or the slaughter of a score of holy men. These were all but eddies of some larger, deeper current, or rather small things crushed by the heedless turning of a mighty wheel. His mind could not grasp what it all might mean, and the more he thought, the more elusive such ideas became. He only understood that he had fallen beneath the wheel's broad shadow, and if he were to survive, he must harden himself to its dreadful revolutions. Slumped on the bank, the thin fizz of the insects who hovered over the stream filling the air, Simon unwrapped the pages of Morghenes' Life of Prester John and began to leaf through it. He had not looked at it in some time, due to long marching and early bedtime once camp was made. He pulled apart some of the pages where they had stuck to each other, reading a sentence here, a handful of words there, not caring so much what it said as indulging in the comforting memory of his friend. Staring at the script, he remembered the old man's slender, blue-veined hands, nimble and clever as nest-building birds. A passage caught his eye. It was on a page following a crude, hand-drawn map that the doctor had titled at the bottom, "The Battlefield at Nearulla." The sketch itself was of little interest, as for some reason the old man had not bothered to label any of the armies or landmarks, nor had he included an explanatory caption. The subsequent text, however, leaped out at him, an answer of a sort to thoughts that had been plaguing him since the awful discovery of the day before.
"Neither war nor violent death," Morghenes had written, "have anything uplifting about them. Yet they are the candle to which humanity flies again and again, as complacently as the lowly moth. He who has been upon a battlefield, and who is not blinded by popular conceptions, will confirm that on this ground, mankind seems to have created a hell on earth out of sheer impatience, rather than waiting for that original to which, if the priests are correct, most of us will eventually be ushered. Still, it is the field of war that determines those things that God has forgotten, accidentally or not what mortal can know, to order and arrange. Hence, it is often the arbiter of divine will, and violent death is its law, scribe."
Simon smiled and drank a little water. He remembered very well Morgaini's habit of comparing things to other things, like people to bugs, and death to a wrinkly old archive priest. Usually these comparisons had been beyond Simon, but sometimes as he strained to follow the twists and turns of the old man's thoughts, a meaning had come clear all of a sudden, like a curtain drawn from in front of a sunny window.
John Presbyter, the doctor had also written, was without doubt one of the greatest warriors of the age, and without that ability would never have risen to his final royal state. But it was not his battling that made him a great king, rather it was his use of the tools of kingship that battling brought into his hands, his statecraft and his example to the common people. In fact, his greatest strengths on the field of combat were his worst failings as high king. In the pitch of battle, he was a fearless, laughing killer, a man who destroyed the lives of those who came against him with the cheerful enjoyment of an Utanyeet hedge baron, arrow-feathering a buck deer. As a king, he was sometimes prone to quick action and heedlessness, and it was in that way he very nearly lost the Battle of Elvrit's Halladale, and did lose the goodwill of the conquered Rimasgarders.
Simon frowned as he traced along the passage. He could feel sunlight slipping down through the trees to heat the back of his neck. He knew he really should get the water skin back to Binnabik, but it had been so long since he had sat quietly by himself, and he was most curiously surprised to read Morgaini's apparently speaking ill of the golden, indomitable Prester John, a man who figured in so many songs and stories that only the name of Osiris Aedan was better known in all the world, and that not by a long measure.
By contrast, the passage continued, the one man who was John's match on the field of war was his virtual opposite, Camaris Sor Venita, last prince of the Navanay royal house, and brother of the current duke, was a man to whom war seemed only another fleshly distraction. Astride his horse, Atarin, and with a great sword, Fawn, in his hand, he was probably the most deadly man in our world. Yet he took no pleasure from battle, and his great skill was only a burden, in that his mighty reputation brought many against him who would otherwise have had no cause, and forced him to kill when he would not. It is said in the Book of the Aedan that when the priests of Uvenis came to arrest Holy Osiris, he went willingly, but when they purposed to take also his acolytes, Sutrines and Granis, Osiris Aedan would not have it, and slew the priests with a touch of his hand. He wept at the slaying and blessed their bodies. So it was with Camaris, if so sacrilegious a comparison can be made. If anyone approached the terrible power and universal love which Mother Church imputes to Osiris, Camaris was that one, a warrior who killed with no hatred for his enemies, and yet was the most terrifying fighter of this, or probably any other. Simon, will you please come quickly? I need water, and I'm needing it now.
The sound of Binnabik's voice, harsh with urgency, made Simon jump guiltily. He scrambled up the bank toward the camp. But Camaris was a great fighter. All the songs described him laughing heartily as he hewed the heads from the wild men of the Thrivings. Shem used to sing one. How did it go? He gave them the left side. He gave them the right side. He shouted and he sang as they ran and showed their backside. Camaris came a-laughing. Camaris came a-fighting. Camaris came a-riding through the battle of the Thrivings. As he emerged from the brush, Simon saw in the bright sunlight how had the sun gotten so high that Hengfisk had returned and that he and Binnabik were crouching over the supine form of Brother Langrian. Here, Binnabik, Simon handed the skin bag to the kneeling troll.
It was a fine long time you were,
Binnabik began, then broke off shaking the water bag.
Half full, he said,
and the look on his face made Simon blush with shame.
I had just drunk some when you called, he offered.
Hengfisk turned a reptilian eye on him and scowled.
Well,
Binnebik said, returning to Langrian, who looked much rosier than Simon remembered.
Climbed is climbed, fallen is fallen. I think our friend here is to be improving.
He lifted the bag and squirted a few drops of water into Langrian's mouth. The unconscious monk coughed and sputtered for a moment. Then his throat moved convulsively as he swallowed.
Do you see? Binnebik asked proudly. It is the wound on the head that I believe I am.
Before Binnebik could finish his explanation, Langrian's eyes fluttered open. Simon heard Hengfisk suck in a sharp breath. Langrian's gaze wandered blearily over the faces that hovered above him. Then his eyes fell shut again.
My water, troll, hissed Hengfisk.
What am I doing here is what I know, Rimmer's man,
Binnebik replied with icy dignity.
You were already performing your duty when you pulled him from the ruins. Now I am at performing mine, and need no suggestions.
As he spoke, the little man trickled water past Langrian's cracked lips. After some moments, the monk's thirst-swollen tongue pushed out of his mouth, like a bear coming up from a winter's sleep. Binnebik moistened it with the bag, then dampened a cloth and draped it across Langrian's forehead, which was traced with healing cuts. Finally, he opened his eyes again and seemed to focus on Hengfisk. The Rimmer's man took Langrian's hand in his.
Hey, Hen,
Langrian croaked. Hengfisk pressed the damp cloth against the skin.
Don't speak, Langrian. Rest.
Langrian turned his eyes slowly from Hengfisk to Binnebik and Simon, then back to the monk.
Athas,
he managed to say.
Rest now. You must rest.
This man and I are agreeing at last on something,
Binnebik smiled at his patient.
You should take sleep.
Langrian appeared to want to speak more, but before he could, his eyelids slid down, as if heeding advice, and he slept. Two things happened that afternoon. The first occurred while Simon, the monk, and the troll were eating a sparse meal. Since Binnebik had not wanted to leave Langrian, there was no fresh game. The trio made do with dried meat and the products of Simon and Hengfisk's foraging, berries and a few greenish nuts. As they sat, chewing silently, each wrapped in his own very different thoughts, Simon's an equal mixture of the horrid dream wheel and the triumphant battlefield figures of John and Camaris, Brother Dokkais suddenly died. One moment he was sitting quietly, awake but not eating. He had refused the berries Simon offered him, staring like a mistrustful animal until the boy took them away. And a moment later he had rolled over on his face, quivering at first and then pitching violently. By the time the others could turn him over, his eyes had rolled up, showing a ghastly white in his dirt-smeared face. A moment later, he had quit breathing, although his body remained as rigid as a spar. Shaken as he was, Simon was certain that just before the final passion, he had heard Dokkais whisper,
Storm King!
The words burned in his ears and troubled his heart, although he did not know why, unless he had heard them in his dream. Neither Binnebik nor the monk said anything, but Simon was sure they had both heard. Hengfisk, to Simon's surprise, wept bitterly over the body. He himself, in some strange way, felt almost relieved, a bizarre emotion that he could neither understand nor quell. Binnebik was as unreadable as stone. The second thing happened as Binnebik and Hengfisk were arguing an hour or so later.
And I am agreeing we will help, but you are upon the wrong ledge if you think to order me.
Binnebik's anger was tightly controlled, but his eyes had narrowed to black slashes beneath his brows.
But you will only help bury Dokkais. Would you leave the others to be food for wolves?
Hengfisk's anger was not at all controlled, and his eyes pushed out, wide and staring in his reddening face.
I tried to help Dokkais, the troll snapped. I failed. We will bury him, if that is what you wish. But it is not my plan to be spending 3 days to bury all of your dead brethren. And there are worse purposes they could serve than food for wolves, and perhaps dead while living, some of them.
It took a moment for Hengfisk to work out Binnabig's tangled speech. But when he did, his color grew even brighter, if such was possible.
You heathen monster! How can you speak ill of unburied dead? You poisonous dwarf!
Binnabig smiled, a flat, deadly smile.
If your god loves them so, then he has taken their souls, yes, up to heaven, and to be lying around will do harm only to their mortal bodies.
Before another word could be spoken, both combatants were startled out of their dispute by a deep growl from Kantaka, who had been napping on the far side of the fire pit, beside Langrian. In a moment it became clear what had startled the grey wolf. Langrian was talking.
Someone warned the abbot.
Treachery!
The monk's voice was a harsh whisper.
Brother, Hengfisk cried, leaping quickly to his side. Save your strength.
Let him speak, Binnabig replied. It might be saving our lives, Rimmer's man.
Before Hengfisk could respond, Langrian's eyes were open. Staring first at Hengfisk, then at his surroundings, the monk shuddered as though with a chill, despite being wrapped in a heavy cloak.
Hengfisk, he grated. The others? Are they?
All dead,
said Binnabig plainly.
The Rimmersman shot him a hateful glance. Osiris has taken them back, Langrian, he said. Only you were spared.
I feared it.
Can you tell us what happened?
The troll leaned forward and put another damp cloth on the monk's forehead. Simon could see now for the first time behind the blood and scars.